and welcome to Rise Up HR. Thank you so much for downloading this podcast. I am your host, Brenda Sabater, and we're so glad you can join us today. Please be sure to follow and subscribe to us on Anchor, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, and any platform where you listen to your favorite podcasting programs. Follow us on Instagram. Our handle is riseup_HR. To be a guest on this show, submit a topic of interest, have questions or feedback about this or other episodes on this show, please email us to connect@riseuphr.net. That is connect@riseuphr.net. Talk to you soon. An employment visa allows a person to work in the United States. And in many instances, small or large companies must sponsor the applicant for the visa. It is therefore so important for businesses to create a strong employment immigration strategy to prepare for the future, especially in the new administration and the uncertainty that it comes with regards to immigration law. It is why we invited Lucy Magardishian to our show. She comes from a diverse immigration law background, having practiced immigration law for over a decade. Lucy comes with a deep understanding of immigration law intricacies and offers her clients strategic, innovative, and creative solutions to the most complex immigration matters. Lucy represents clients from all sectors, including technology, financial services, healthcare, hospitality, fashion, other entrepreneurs, and investors seeking to establish businesses in the United States. It is with great pleasure and honor to welcome Lucy Magardishian to our show. Welcome, Lucy.
Thanks, Brenda, for having me. It's great to be on your show, and hopefully your listeners can gain some knowledge of this really the hottest field, I think, right now, and probably the most challenging one of the most challenging fields at the same time. So I just want to say we're just going to have a discussion today, and nothing I say should be construed as legal advice. I'm just going to discuss strategies the way I do things, but attorneys have different strategies and different methods of doing things. A lot of information is changing because we have a new administration. So we are expecting certain executive orders to come down in the coming weeks. So everything we're going to talk about today, I'm basing on information based on last year, the way the H-1B filing was done and through prior years. But we are anticipating some changes as the weeks come on. So a lot of what we talk today may change in the coming weeks. The past 4 years, my opinion, has been quite the roller coaster. We've all had, the administration loved to keep us on our toes, and a lot of last minute executive orders were handed down, changes were happening, and it's sometimes strategizing. We strategized one way, but it turned out that we need to change strategy. And it was a bit difficult to manage expectations for clients. So hopefully with a little more clarity with this new administration, hopefully things will be a little smoother, but time will only tell. For the most part, I think the H-1B is the most popular and probably the most difficult visa to obtain, just because it has undergone a lot of changes, and I believe they will, you know, probably be further strengthened and maybe even harder to obtain, but we're yet to see.
Right. And this is so important to have this discussion now, especially with the new administration, with so many changes that has happened. By all means, not getting into political matters, because it's not about that. But it does affect, HR matters. It does affect employment matters. And that's why it's so prevalent to even bring that up. you know, because of this, we have lost, we have so many unfulfilled jobs because of some issues that we've had with the H1 B process and so many other processes that take place in getting the right people to fill these positions. And a lot of companies have suffered tremendously because, unfortunately, and I'm sure you're going to get into a little bit details about the process of, you know, applying for an H1 B, but it does create a lot of pressure for most companies. And also for, you know, the transitioning from a student to a worker to, you know, what's the future like? So in a world of uncertainties, Lucy, why don't you tell us a little bit more about what is like a broad aspect of H1B, right? And connect that to the value of what's happening now with businesses with regards to that.
Sure. The H-1B program allows U.S. Employers to employ foreign workers. And it has been a very popular program throughout the years. A lot of employers rely on foreign talent. And a lot of those U.S. employers are hiring U.S. graduates that have come off bachelor's degrees or U.S. master's programs. And you know, to remain competitive, they want to hire the brightest and the you know, to retain talent in the U.S. So H-1Bs have been popular, but they also have been rife with through the years with a lot of fraud. Employers were using the programs, but never really employing employees. So slowly, they started introducing certain measures where to check on employers to make sure that the jobs are legit and no foreign workers are being used and underpaid than what was already put on the application. So H-1Bs, there's 65,000 H-1Bs available per fiscal year, plus additional 20,000 for graduates of a U.S. master's program. So a total of 85,000. This number is it's set by Congress. And in previous years, there always used to be more applicants than there were allotted numbers. So what happened is this lottery system was created. And prior to 2020, we used to submit packets and prepare all the documents and the government would run the lottery and it would take 2 to 3 months to find out what happened, whether or not the case was selected. Well, you know, it's with the last year in 2020, for fiscal year 2021, the government's fiscal year always starts in October. So for fiscal year 2021, they created an electronic registration, which I think was extremely cost effective. And I got very positive feedback from employers because we do simple electronic registration. The lottery selection is conducted. The employer and attorney are notified. And then we move forward with preparing the onerous application and submit it to the government. That way you don't have to prepare applications and submit it blindly and not know what's going to happen. You just prepare cases that are selected. And I think it's also less burden on the government. So I think it's win-win on all sides. And I had companies and my employers tell me, oh, this is great. You know, I save some money. Yes, we'd love for you to pay big bucks to us. But at the same time, I think it's an economic, it's a good economic decision on companies and, you know, attorneys at the same time. It's like, you know, it's cost effective and it's cost effective for a government. So the way the electronic registration is conducted or was conducted in 2020, they open a registration window between March 1st and March 20th. Employers were able to create accounts with the help of the attorneys. A $10 fee was paid, and then the application was submitted. And then between March 21st and March 31st, they ran the lottery and they sent electronic notifications of who's selected. And then they allowed, the government allowed 90-day filing period to submit all the selected applications. So that was very efficient. We're waiting to see what they will do this year, if it's going to be the same filing window. Before the Trump administration left, they did submit certain changes to the way the lottery is to be conducted. And the new rule, which right now there's a temporary freeze, but we don't know yet because the DHS, Department of Homeland Security, USCIS is under DHS. They have to take an affirmative action to actually freeze this new rule. So we're yet to see. Hopefully in the coming week or 2 weeks, we'll have a little more clarity. But if the new rule remains, the way they're going to conduct the lottery is anyone that has the highest wage pretty much is a shoo-in. They get in. And then it's going to trickle down to the next highest and so on and so forth. So Department of Labor usually has four-tiered wages. So anyone that meets level four wage, it pretty much gets the highest chance of selection. But we don't know if that's going to happen yet. Hopefully not, because the previous administration was very focused on very high salaries. And I think that became quite a challenge because we have some startups and they can't afford to pay such high wages. And then we're yet to see, because there's another proposed change that prevailing wages are going to go up in July. We don't know if that's going to happen, but if that happens, then it's going to bring minimum wages so high that, you know, I think it will be almost unrealistic to, I'm not even sure how smaller employers will be able to hire employees. So we're yet to see. These are the two main changes. We're yet to see what's going to happen, but, in general, the way, you know, I sit down with companies, and I'm one of those very proactive individuals. And the earlier we start, the better it is, just so we can have a little bit of a wiggle room to decide, is this the best course of action, and is this the best visa, and so forth, and strategize with HR or employer or individual client.
Right. Let's dig in deeper with that, because, you know, coming from the HR world and working with finance and working with other folks in the leadership team, when requesting, you know, someone that requires an H-1B visa, I mean, this is not a, oh, let's get someone for this position, let's apply for the visa and have them start in 1 week. I mean, that is completely unrealistic. And although that's a wishful thought, what is truly, you know, from A through Z, the process in getting this, you know, process completed from start to finish, and what is truly the time frame in all that, and how long does it take?
Sure. So first of all, you know, I want to give it a little bit of background. Who qualifies for an H-1B? It's just that it's not everybody that qualify for an H-1B. So the H-1B pretty much requires is required for a professional or specialty occupation that requires at least a bachelor's degree. And specifically, the law says that you need to have attained a bachelor's or higher degree. The position is a specialty occupation. The degree is common in the industry. The employer normally requires a degree. And the nature of the duties are so specific and specialized that that requires, they're specialized and complex, that require certain knowledge gained from the degree to perform the duties. So usually then we need to show nexus between the job duties and the degree. And that has been a really big issue with immigration, to show the nexus between the degree and the job duties. So, you know, financial occupation certainly qualify, tech, healthcare. I mean, there's a vast amount of occupations and job duties that qualify for an H-1B. So not only do you have to have a bachelor's degree, but you have to perform complex duties that require it.
Absolutely. Now, let's talk a little bit about that, right? Too, because one of the things and one of the major things is to prove yourself, right? You have to prove that this job cannot be held by anybody in the United States. In my opinion, and of course, we've been through this, it how difficult it is to show proof that no one here in the US, like you would have to scan the entire United States to make sure that you couldn't find someone or transfer someone from California to New York or Chicago to New York or whatever the case may be, right? Like, how can you prove this? What's the test behind that?
Well, I mean, you have to meet the criteria. So it's not like this particular visa doesn't require an employer to advertise. But, you know, a lot of times employers do hire somebody that's coming right out of school. So, and it's, you know, they take someone because obviously they're younger, they're more knowledgeable. Or sometimes they hire people with experience. And I've heard, you know, companies that said, oh, we've advertised, we couldn't find somebody that's qualified, and now we have this foreign national that has the right experience. So, you know, I've had situations like that where it's not necessarily somebody that's a graduate of a US program, but if I have had individuals, companies sponsor some employees that are foreign. For example, if it's a foreign company and they bring a specialist from abroad, and you know, they're just establishing themselves in the US. So H-1B is one vehicle that can be used depending on the type of work this foreign national will be. For example, it could be an executive or it could be somebody that has special knowledge. Yes, there are certain visas that are particularly tied to an international company that we will discuss at our next podcast. But in the context of H-1B, it remains available. And some individuals do prefer an H-1B because it gives a little more flexibility. You could work for multiple employers, provided each employer files an H-1B, because H-1Bs are employer specific. So you could work for multiple employers as long as each one files an H-1B. It does allow you to go from H-1B to a green card because H-1B has the dual intent. It's a non-immigrant, it is a non-immigrant visa, but it's one of those visas that yes, you could be temporarily employed, but you could also seek and you could have the intent to immigrate and go for a green card.
Right. Let's pause for a minute there because this is getting really very interesting, right? So just before you said that it is much better to apply for an H-1B visa because of all the benefits that it comes with. I mean, just saying that you can even apply for a green card, but how much more difficult is that versus a J-1 visa, right? To get. Is it recommended? Like if you're under pressure and you need that talent in your workplace, would you recommend someone going for a J-1 versus an H-1B or?
Well, I mean, it depends. I mean, this is something that needs to be evaluated with each individual company and the company's needs. So J-1 is very limited. You know, it's just a trainee visa. So if you want to come and train somebody, yes, you can. If you're a hospital and you want to bring, you know, you're bringing in foreign doctors and they're required to do residency, yes, J-1 is an option. A lot of hospitals hire physicians on J-1s, but the J-1 has, it's limited. It requires you, certain J-1s have a 2-year foreign residency requirement. Certain occupations are on an exchange skills list that even if you come in and do your training for 12 months, you may be subject to go home. So in order to change to any kind of visa, you need a waiver. If your occupation is subject to an exchange list, run by Department of the list is published by Department of State, then you need to get a waiver. It's called no objection waiver from your home country. If you're a doctor on a J-1 and you want to continue on after you graduate your residency program or your fellowship, then you need a waiver. And there are certain options to get waivers for doctors. So the J-1 is more restrictive. And it gives you a little bit of a, you know, difficulty sometimes to just, you can't just jump from one visa category to another.
Got it. Got it.
But if you're a student and you just finished your school and you're on an optical practical training, you have the 12 months
Right.
To finish to find a job, and usually those on OPT, optical practical training, OPT, you switch to H-1Bs. Or if somebody's in a STEM program, they're allowed a 24-month extension, so that gives them a few tries to go on the lottery. So I've had clients where we've tried 1 year and then didn't get the lottery the 1 year, and then we try the second year and get it. Finally, on third year, they're running out of their 2 year their STEM OPT extension, and finally we get the H-1B. And then another thing to be kept in mind, for especially for companies, if the H-1B gets selected through the lottery, which you know most companies and employers know by March 31st. An application needs to be filed with immigration, and immigration has to approve the application. So it's not an automatic guaranteed slam dunk approval. Mm. You put the job duties, the credentials of the employee, the information about the employer. So it is a whole packet gets submitted to immigration, and you make the strongest presentation to meet the statutory criteria. And explain to government is like why this is a specialty occupation and how this individual meets the requirements and how the degree relates to the job duties. And if the government is satisfied, the immigration officer is satisfied, yes, they grant the H-1B. They approve it. And the start date is always the start of the fiscal year, which is October 1st.
Okay.
So if you have a student that's on OPT that's running out in the middle of this period where the H-1B is pending adjudication, the OPT automatically gets extended through September 30th.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that allows continuity of employment
right.
until the H-1B kicks in. That's if somebody's in the United States.
Right.
Sometimes if status is an issue and the person needs to leave the U.S., because remember, OPT ends and there's a 60-day grace period. So if the OPT ended in February and the H-1B is getting filed, got selected and it's getting filed in April, well, that person can't remain here if they ran out of their OPT 60-day grace period. F-1 grace period, 60-day grace period. Then they have to go home and then the application ultimately gets approved by immigration, but they will be required, the foreign national will be required to go to the consulate in their home country or wherever they're based and obtain an actual visa stamp in their passport that would allow them to enter into the U.S. 10 days before the start of employment of October 1st.
Right.
Right. So that's something to be kept in mind with employers is it's not that October 1st is the start date, unless you have somebody that has an OPT that gets bridged during the ending of the OPT and the start of the H-1B. So it's good to talk to employers, especially if they're hiring somebody that's graduating from a master's program or from a U.S. bachelor's program. Start early, talk to a lawyer, maybe a year before that, maybe just so you're aware of what's the timeline and when do you start the process? And right now I'm lining up cases because come mid-February, we'll have the idea of when the registration is going to happen. So that way I prepare my employers. It's like, this is what I need and start working on the documents and we can be ready for the filing window when it opens.
Right, right. So important to make sure that you have all your T's crossed and I've got it with this. And fortunately, there are practitioners like yourself who helps businesses, especially in the STEM field, who are mostly affected by the administration when it changes. And I mean, the last report that I read was through the U.S. Department of Labor. Over 2.5 million jobs were unfilled. In the STEM industry. Do you expect that number rising or going down in the coming new administration?
Considering COVID put a dent on a lot of things and it certainly affected the H-1B filing for last year in 2020, because they conducted the lottery and then COVID happened and all the lockdowns, a lot of businesses suffered. So not a lot of applications were filed. Mm-hmm. So what happened was the government didn't receive enough applicants and they ran a second lottery.
Oh my God. Okay.
So, and I know I had some employers up until the last minute, they weren't sure if they're going to go forward. The businesses were suffering and they couldn't, they said, can we pay this person? We don't know yet, but they ultimately, we found the solution and we ended up securing the H-1B and getting that person employed in the U.S.
Oh.
So it was a big, big sigh of relief.
That's excellent. That's excellent.
Yeah, and it was a hospitality. Well, a little bit of more of a hospitality industry, and then
yeah.
I think certain industries probably got affected more than others. But I think loss of business, furloughing employees, letting go of staff, I think that affected big time the H-1Bs for smaller businesses. I probably wouldn't say the same for big corporations. And I think, you know, STEM is a hot field, and I feel like it's going to continue to grow, and we'll just have to see what happens.
Right. So you mentioned which is part of the package, right? You have to show their credentials and stuff like that. But yes. You also mentioned job posting. Does it really matter if I post a job or not? And if so, how long do I have to demonstrate that I really tried? This was on Indeed. This was on LinkedIn for X amount of time. And I truly couldn't find anyone.
Well, the H-1B does not require you to advertise for the position. But it does require part of the package. Not only do you submit certain forms that are required by immigration, but you are supposed to submit what's called a labor condition application. And basically it's called an LCA, labor condition application, and that's administered by Department of Labor. And basically the LCA requirement is to ensure fair labor practices, including paying both US and foreign workers at least 100% of the prevailing wage. Mm-hmm. And that is to protect against displacement of US workers and to ensure adequate working condition. And it's an electronic application that's filed online that the employer makes attestations that the H-1B worker will be paid the higher of the prevailing wage for the job in the locality, or the actual wage paid to other workers in similar positions at the company. For example, you can't hire a foreign national and pay the foreign national $50,000 for a job that somebody else in the company is performing at $100,000 an hour. $100,000 a year. So mm-hmm. you cannot have such a big disproportionate gap if they're of the same similar occupation and similar experience. The other attestation is any benefits will be offered to the H-1B workers on the same basis as of the company's other workers. The H-1B workers who have similar working conditions to other workers at the company, and the working conditions provided to the H-1B will not have a negative impact on the working condition of other similar workers, and there's no strike or lockout at the work location. So that application or a notice or whatever their attorney uses to help employers needs to be posted and basically puts everybody on notice saying, we're going to hire a foreign worker, and this is going to be the salary and the position we're hiring. So that's mandated by Department of Labor. To secure a wage and to make sure that, you know, everything that I read is met by them,
right,
by the U.S. employer. And there has to be an employer-employee relationship. So on H-1B, you need to hire somebody, whether it's a full-time or part-time, but on a salary W-2, you cannot be an independent contractor. Although I think it's a gray area, and maybe somebody will argue that you can be an independent contractor, but my conservative view is no, you need to have an employer-employee relationship,
right,
and pay somebody on a W-2 and get a regular paycheck, just like any other employee.
Right. I, I did receive a question from someone who actually is following us, and here's the question. It's from Emmanuel, and his question is, my immigration status is a J-1 exchange visitor. Am I eligible for an H-1B status, and how long would that take?
Well, there's a little more analysis that needs to be done as to what kind of J-1 and would he need a waiver or not. Depends on the type of job, depends on who's the employer, depends on the salary. It's a good question, but we need to do an analysis. It's too broad of a question, and I suggest that if Emmanuel has an employer and willing to go through the H-1B, that he speaks to an immigration attorney so he can get proper advice.
What would be the next step? So let's say Emmanuel goes through the process, you know, he's still transitioning from a J-1. It's about to expire. He because it's a temporary visa. As you mentioned earlier, it's a limited visa. And, you know, he really likes where he's working at. How do you express this to an employer that you need a sponsorship? And, you know, what would be the actionable things to do to prepare the employer for these things? Can you share that process with us?
Yeah, absolutely. I do that quite often when I sit down and I tell employers and nudge them up. You have to, if you really like this person, then you have to pretty much get your act together and let's get them here on a visa or and strategize. But yeah, you know, absolutely. I get on the phone with HR or if the startup, whoever's in charge, and then I go over and I said, you need to retain this person. Well, these are the steps. You know, if it's somebody or it's a trainee, J-1, I have to look on the skills list and see, okay, is this subject to the foreign residence requirement? And does this person need a waiver? And if they're on the skills list and they need a waiver, then we have to contact the consulate, the home country consulate, to obtain no objection waiver. So that takes time because not only do you involve Department of State, but you also have to involve USCIS. And you know, that may take time. It may take a few months. It may take six months. I mean, with COVID, everything has been delayed. So
there's a lot of risk in that because by that time, the visa will expire.
So exactly. And then we have to say, well, this person has to go home if we cannot get the no objection, let's say, and the time frame that they're here. The J-1s have a 30-day grace period. But beyond that, I would say, provided they're as a trainee now, if it's a physician or if it's somebody in the academic world, maybe it's slightly different, but because the different kind of waivers that are done, and usually with I deal with a lot of also healthcare workers and with physicians, if they're done with a fellowship and they know where they start at least a year to a year and a half before they're done with a fellowship to transition them, to get them a waiver, and then transition them to an H-1B. So it needs to be evaluated more in detail as to, you know, the visa, the type of the and then time it that way.
Right. I mean, I'm telling you, this coming from the HR world, I mean, there's been quite a few intricacies when it comes to this application. And I know as a practitioner, I can't do it without any legal direction, legal advice. I know some practitioner can do that, but I find that they oftentimes delay the process because they're so focused on just pushing out the paperwork and not on the detail. And, you know, there are some other practitioners that does it really well without any legal direction because they've done so many of them. But, you know, when you're coming from an environment, like say for construction or in a hospital or any other environment, or even a small medical boutique organization, and, you know, the person's unaware how to process this. I mean, what do you recommend for someone like that? And how do you walk them through to really obtain without getting all these anxieties, like, oh my gosh, I need this person in, and, you know, or this person's visa is about to expire. How can you walk them through it to make your job easier, more effective in that partnership so that the job can still function and we're not missing out, you know, staff members?
I mean, if my recommendation is, and I've actually had this happen, it was a startup company that they contacted me last year. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, we have a couple of foreigners. What can we do about them? Okay, I said, when are they graduating? One of them was a student on an OPT, and then they said, well, we just hired her, she has her OPT. I said, great, that means we have to do an H-1B for her come next year. Contact me in January. I had the conversation over the summer. I said, contact me in January. Lo and behold, January 4th, I got the phone call. And they said, hi, Lucy, I'm ready to move forward and sponsor my my employee. Great. And then I went over and explained everything, that it's a lottery, that it's a registration, things are changing, but I need to make an assessment. What kind of a job is it? How much are you paying this person? Where are you located? Those are key things, especially the salary, because I think that's the toughest job, to tell employers what you're offering does not meet the Department of Labor. Prevailing wages. Mm-hmm. And the government became very tough on the H-1Bs. Mm-hmm. I think three years ago, I think when the new administration came in, I can't quite remember right now, but they started denying cases for anyone that had put level one as the prevailing wage, which is the lowest of mm-hmm, the wages. And it became a huge issue. That's why it's important to talk to employers and explain to them, like, this is the job classification. And then this is what the minimum wage will be. And I tell them, is if you don't start at level one, you have to start at level two.
Right.
So it's very important that gets conveyed to employers, especially the salary, what it needs to be for the position. And if they are going to go with the highest wages, then if you're going to offer level one or level two, then you have a very minimal chance of getting selected if this goes through. So we'll just have to wait and see.
Right.
But that's a very important conversation from the get-go that the employer has to understand, that that's probably the, not only are the job duties, but also the salaries are the most important thing in an application.
Right.
And then, timing, of course, if somebody's running out of status, and obviously it's not going to be magic, because you have to know, okay, we have to go through the registration. Okay, we find out at the end of March. But if the person already ran out of status, they probably have to go home. You can't stay here without kind of legal status. Sometimes if they don't get selected in the H-1B, and because it's an electronic process, you sort of know at the end of March, then you could counsel and say, okay, well, your employee didn't get selected in the H-1B category through the lottery for this year, but let's strategize and see, are they on a visa possible? Can they continue with school? So it's between January, I'd say probably April is a good time to talk to employers and sort of line work and timelines, and or if it's somebody toward the end of the year that you know you're going to be hiring for a national, then yes, definitely get in touch with an attorney, so that way you'll have a timeline set.
You know, some of the most common questions that come up is, well, what would my status be for my spouse and children when I get granted my H-1 visa status? What should we tell them? Like, what is the expectation? So this individual gets their H-1B visa. Yay. What would that mean for their family?
Oh, okay. So H-1Bs can bring dependents. And there's an H-4 available for dependents.
Is that a form, the H-4?
Yeah. Well, it depends. If they're all the individuals are here in the U.S. and the case is filed in the U.S. as a change of status from one non-immigrant status into another, yes, you could file a form for the dependents. There's a separate fee for that. And or if they're abroad, then everybody goes to the consulate and get their visa. Right. The H-4s dependents do not have the right to work unless, because H-1B maxes out at 6 years. So if certain categories, certain countries have a green card wait periods, because there's a certain limit on that too. So anyone that has an approved immigrant petition and it's on seventh year or eighth year of H-1B, H-4s are allowed to get employment authorization. So that's the beauty of it, because we have a lot of individuals, especially from India and China, that are waiting so many years for a green card, and they have approved immigrant petitions, but because of immigrant visa visa ceilings that are set, that we'll talk about it next time on our podcast when we talk about green cards. But those individuals with approved immigrant petitions can get H-1B extension beyond the 6 years, and spouses can get employment authorization. But the otherwise, if you're on the first 6 years and you don't have an immigrant petition approved, then the spouse.
Lucy, you have no idea how much you've saved my life, you know, with, you know, working with customers and different situations that we faced when it comes to this. I mean, it's just been it's a complex thing. And I think earlier in the conversation, it is true that the Trump administration has made matters worse, unfortunately. What expectation do you have for the new administration? I mean, you went light on that one without getting into politics, but like I said, it does affect the administration of the process of how things work when it comes to immigration employment. What are your expectations, and how do you see this, you know, flowing from here on in the next 4 years?
Well, I mean, even during the Trump administration, a lot of the draconian and drastic actions they took, they were litigated, and the courts struck down a lot of the changes they wanted to make. I'm hoping that this wage-based selection process does not go through. I'm hoping that the salaries increases don't happen, because I think that would just affect businesses in general, but you know, that's my opinion. I'm not entirely sure what ultimately DHS, USCIS is going to do. They are given the 60 days, so I guess to come up with a plan and say, yes, this is working or this is not working.
Right.
You know, I'm coming from the past 4 years of you know, the unexpected roller coaster. You just go up and down constantly. I don't know. I'm not thinking too far ahead. And given the pandemic, I mean, it's challenging, but you know, at the same time, I just don't want to. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to give an answer to something that I don't know, and I mean, I also tell my clients, I said, I don't know what's going to happen.
Right. And I think that's really the best answer to what's going on. Because it's really, there's a lot of uncertainties, right? When it comes to this. You know, with everything else that's happening in this world, I just hope that it does get improved. I mean, we do need to fill up these STEM positions. I think it's important to, you know, to provide people in these positions, especially when we can't find them internally. And also those international companies that have, you know, US presence, and how they can, you know, support their staff members who are coming from abroad here. That's also very important to do and support. You know, with everything that's going on now, you know, what happens, right? Because I think we need to also look at the side where an employee does not get an H-1B visa, right? What happens to the employer? What's the next step at that point? And what would happen to the person? No sponsorship or no H-1B, you know, et cetera.
I mean, that's the conversation as I said, we'll find out end of March. Okay, H-1B selected, not selected. And I actually had somebody last year, had a client, and that did not get selected even through the second round of lotteries. She ended up going back home. And we decided to just go forward with straightforward green card. But we had discussed the option of going back to school. We evaluated
Right.
potential other employment in academia, because if you, let's say, are employed by a university, you're exempt from that H-1B cap. We explore options. I mean, depends on the field, depends on the person's credentials. There are other visa options that we'll cover at our next
On our next
podcast.
podcast.
Yeah,
It's
so whether it's an international company and they can bring employees on an L or E, or people start their own businesses on an E investor visa, or there's an O-1 visa for people of exceptional ability. So there are options, but I do go over this with employers, and I do ask for resume, and I do want to get an idea of, we always have to have plan B.
Right. Lucy, you have done so much in this arena. What motivates you in helping? Because you also help family-based immigration cases and naturalizations. What motivates you to work with the with this industry, and who are your main clients when it comes to you helping them? Like, walk us through that.
I mean, I'm a solo practitioner, so my focus has mainly been business immigration. I work with startups and small to mid-sized companies. I do represent clients in the healthcare. I do get individual clients for family-based cases. It's been challenging. But at the same time, when you make a difference in somebody's life, it's very rewarding.
Absolutely.
I tell clients, I think the most phrase I've always used is be patient. Be patient. You have to practice a lot of patience, because certain things are out of everybody's control. Maybe they're working at a government agency, there's a bureaucracy, there's a paperwork, it takes forever right now to get receipt notices out of the government, because there are locked back facilities. They're working with reduced staff. The immigration officer are working from home like the rest of us. And a lot of it is juggling, alleviating anxiety and nerves, and just say it's going to be okay. There's always a strategy. There's always a plan. But at times it can get very challenging and frustrating, and this is a life decision.
It
A lot of doctors make life and death decisions, but I mean, I feel like immigration lawyers also make quite altering life decisions for somebody's life. I mean, you can't just tell somebody pack your bags and go home. They have kids in school, they have a home. But sometimes it's an unfortunate event, and you have to say, okay, until we come up with some, plan B, or you may have to leave outside and be outside for a period of time until we try again, or reset the clocks, or whatever needs to be done.
Those are very difficult conversations
Yeah.
to have, especially when they've been here, their kids are in school, and they're pretty much accustomed to some of the culture here, and to go back, it's just heartbreaking, especially when sometimes the employer will drop the ball, right? And that's like, how do you repair that? So Lucy, we have about 5 more minutes. What advice would you give to people that you work with, and how can they get in touch with you?
Oh, sure. I mean, I definitely tell people start early, be proactive, don't wait until the last minute. A lot of people love to wait till the last minute. And biggest thing is listen to what your immigration lawyer says. Do not go on your own. I don't care what your friend said and what your friend did. Listen to your lawyer. Yes, there's a lot of things that are unknown, but we know the law. We know the pattern. We know what's been going on. We'll guide you. So your friend's case is different than yours. I always told my doctor patients, it's like, is your patient every single one the same? No. So then the same thing goes. Your case is not the same as your friend's case.
So I'm very adamant about that. Listen to your lawyer. It's very important because sometimes people get themselves in such a mess that tackling that mess may not get the most favorable result at the end.
Absolutely.
And sure, people can definitely get in touch with me. My email is Lucy, L-U-C-Y, at lmaglaw.com. And my phone number is 917-444-5385. And you could certainly share my information through your listeners and forums.
Wonderful. Well, I can't wait to bring you back on the show. I mean, if we did everything, if we talked about everything you do, right? I mean, I think we'll have several podcasts and or be on this podcast for several hours. But there's more time for that. And I'm really, I mean, I really appreciate you having on the show. Thank you so much. You also practice in New York and Connecticut, right? Do you practice anywhere else?
I'm just in New York. Immigration is one of those, it is federal law. So it basically allows us to practice anywhere. I mean, okay. It, I can go to some Caribbean island and still practice immigration law. I'm based in New York City.
Fantastic. Well,
but I represent clients all over the United States. That's the beauty of it when you represent clients from, being an immigration lawyer, you could represent all of
you're a true New Yorker. You went to SUNY Binghamton, right? And you practiced in New York law. So you have definitely great credentials, accolades, and I'm excited to work with you. Our listeners are extremely happy, and I can't wait to bring you back. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening. You're listening to Rise Up HR. I am your host, Brenda Sabater. If you're interested in, you know, being a guest on our show, or you have any questions, please, about this segment in particular, please email Lucy and please email connect@riseuphr.net. That's all for now. Thank you for listening and have a great day. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.